Join us this week as we descend into the darker side of human nature and uncover the shadows that dwell in the unknown. From chilling true crime and gruesome murders to spine-tingling paranormal encounters that defy explanation, we're peeling back the curtain on things that go bump in the night. So grab a flashlight and maybe a blanket, because you're listening to The Guilty and the Ghostly.
You'll be replaced by a ChatGPT eventually.
Most likely already am.
It's all right. That's our destiny for most of us. We'll be replaced by robots and AI.
Yeah. I was just here for a face, and now she's got all the pictures that she needs of me.
And all the voice samples.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's just going to be able to go through past recordings and just be able to pick up words to say.
I think so. Ultimately, I think that's her end goal.
I'll never tell. You'll never know.
Not until you've been outsourced.
Yep.
Who's to say it hasn't happened already?
Yeah, I just let him come in here and hang out just for fun. Right. I'll just tell him that he's doing it.
Blur him out on the YouTube video.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll do an AI video.
There you go. Hey, that would be kind of interesting. I wonder if AI would be able to, like, animate, like, a whole episode.
I know, like, they can do videos, because even in the editing program I have, they can do, like, weird videos and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and, like, turn you into a cartoon or make videos, like our introduction video. I mean, that's all AI.
Mm-hmm.
So, just timed us out, but...
I'm pretty sure they knew.
No.
No, Audrey's actually just a really fancy editor. She went to school to do it,
mm-hmm.
in case you didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And then had y'all stage it. We went to an old library. And
yep.
An old tunnel. And you didn't even know.
Mm-mm.
I don't even remember recording it.
That's how good I
am. That's how good she
is. Yep. Well, we are back. Seth decided to come over and eat with us. We were going to watch Super Bowl, but not a single streaming platform that we pay for, own, buy, whatever. Streams the freaking Super Bowl, and we have like five of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's how it goes. You gotta pay. That's the thing we've ran across all football season is, like, even individual games, they may play one or two a day, or, like, you know, on football games, but they ain't gonna play all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. It's just a way to get more money.
Oh, absolutely. You have to buy the view individually.
It's insane. So instead, we cooked, we played Imposter. That game's fun.
It is pretty fun.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable.
Yeah, and we played it with the kids. The kids got to try it, so it's something that the whole family can do. So that was a lot of fun. Well, I don't really have a whole lot of business. A couple of things I do want to mention. So have you listened to Bobby Mackey's yet?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, come to find out, one of the guys I work with, shout out Tyler, he used to live up there, and he actually went and drank at Bobby Mackey's on several occasions, which is pretty cool.
Did he experience anything?
He said it's a really weird vibe. It definitely has a vibe when you walk in, like you're being watched or you're not the only one in there. I told him he needs to send me, like, if he had any experiences, he needs, like, either send it to me or tell me. So, Tyler, get on that. I need the stories. And what else did we have? Oh, we went to Broken Bow last weekend with some friends.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun, a really cool place. We've been there before, but this was kind of the first time that we went without the kids. Just did what we wanted to do.
It was a good time.
Maybe drank a little too much. We paid for it all week long. We were super tired. But I didn't realize it was Sasquatch territory.
Yeah. Did y'all see any?
We did not see any.
I seen a whole bunch of pictures.
A lot of
Sasquatch?
Yeah. Wow. They even had a real Sasquatch hair that they were selling, but it was $8. We weren't fixing to pay for that.
For some dog hair.
Yeah.
Or Jeffrey's beard hair out of the
Yeah.
I almost did just so we could add it to our shelf of mysterious items.
Was it like in a cool container?
Yeah, it was just like in a little glass jar.
Yeah.
That'd have been fun.
It was kind of cool.
It'd have been interesting. I guess. So what's this hair on them?
That's Sasquatch hairs.
But they actually have a hunting season for Sasquatch in Oklahoma.
So you can't do it year round?
I guess.
Tags. I wonder how many tags have been turned in.
Well, how else do you get real Sasquatch hair?
Good question.
I assume
we'll never know.
Find it on like branches and stuff, right?
I mean, yeah, but they had a lot.
Yeah.
Oh.
A lot.
Wow, I'm leaning toward that's probably Jeffrey's hair, beard hair out the back. Probably.
Let's hope it's his beard hair.
Yeah.
Bocephus's back hair.
Puebla's.
So yeah, that was pretty cool. And since it's late, we're going to go ahead. So today we actually, that was another thing, was personal stories. So I've had two personal accounts sent in already. I'm going to wait till we have a couple more, and maybe we'll do either do a bonus episode, depending on how many we get, or if we get enough, we can do a full episode of just like listener
personal
accounts.
Experiences.
Yeah. So we've got two. We need a few more.
Yeah.
And with that being said, this story is our first listener suggestion. So, Paul Jeffries, he's my little work buddy. He lives in Alabama, and he listens every week. He's one of my RAs, and he'll call me and give me notes and send me some stories that he wants to hear. And this is one that he sent me that he wanted to hear, which I've heard it before, and it was already on my list. So I was like, hey, perfect time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Good deal.
Yeah. So we are going to be covering Ken McElroy. Do you know anything about him?
McElroy?
McElroy, like McDonald's. Elroy.
Can't say I've heard of this fella.
Nothing. Josh knows a little bit. I gave him very vague details.
Yeah, I didn't look into it too much. I wanted to have some sort of surprise whenever I was watching it.
Is this true crime?
Yes.
My understanding, it's pretty rough.
It's pretty wild.
Is it more rough than the torso killer? That one had me,
Yes and no. I mean, how do you say one's worse than the other? You know what I mean? When people's lives are taken or their
body count?
Body count, no.
Maybe the way they go?
You'll see.
Okay.
This is a different story. Okay, so we'll go ahead and dive in. So today we're talking about a man who was so awful that an entire town watched him die.
Okay.
Well, wow.
Collectively decided they saw absolutely nothing. So let's get into it. At just 14 years old, Mabel would marry 20-year-old Tony McElroy. Starting off the bat, great.
What year is this?
That was 19... It was before the 1920s.
Okay, well, I guess that makes it more politically correct.
Ish.
It ain't right now.
Then I think that was still a little...
That's a little
questionable.
14 years old, marries a 20-year-old man.
I'm not entirely sure when that was made different, but I know, you know, obviously way back in the past, age difference was something they didn't even bother with.
Well, you ready to make it worse?
Maybe.
It said that the only reason that they got married was because Mabel was pregnant with Tony's older brother's baby.
What the fuck?
Well, why are they getting married? Why ain't she and Tony getting married?
I don't know.
What?
Yeah.
I'll be that baby. I'll be that baby's peppy.
Yeah. So right off the bat, we're
like, did his brother die and he did the honorable thing? And
I don't think so. Not from what's fixing to take place.
Where did this take place?
Missouri. Don't you just keep your mouth shut.
The show me state. They're showing me new things.
Okay.
Tony and Mabel were able to, they got married, and what they did to make money is they would rent 400 acres of farmland, and I guess corn was their main crop. And there was a drought in the summer of 1927, and it basically wiped out their entire crop. So they were not able to pay for the rent and lost everything.
Wow.
They ended up losing the entire farm, and then after that, Tony had to go back to working low-paying jobs.
And 400 acres back then.
That's a lot.
That's a lot now. You're doing most of that with just small farm equipment.
Yeah.
Well, back then they didn't have big farm equipment. Oh, that was all by hand and
like horse and plow.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they had tractors.
No, they said 1920, right?
Yeah, 1920s.
You said 28.
27. 1927.
Hold up. Hey, Siri.
Giggle it.
When was the first tractor introduced?
The first tractors, in the sense of power traction vehicles, grew out
of... Okay, yeah, possibly.
Okay.
Yeah, see?
Totally possible.
Okay, maybe they did.
Tell me I'm wrong.
Still, 400 acres is a lot, with or without a tractor.
I don't know if
you're talking about small implementation.
So, at the nursery, we have 100, I think it's like 175 acres under irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing what the guys do with our crop, I couldn't imagine 400 acres.
Yeah, you guys have modern equipment.
Yeah. And multiple tractors.
Yeah.
Not just one.
I mean, you're talking about a guy that just specifically does nothing all day but take care of 400 acres of land.
Yep. And that was their entire livelihood. So when that drought hit, they had nothing. And of course, then they lose their house too because their house is on this farmland.
Mm-hmm.
Literally lose everything. After that, Tony had to go back to working low-paying jobs. However, that wouldn't last long because Tony had an explosive temper and was an alcoholic. And then when they lost the land, that just made it that much worse. It was like a downward spiral. Then the Great Depression happened and only made things worse. The couple was struggling financially and they just kept popping out kids.
I mean, what else do you have to do when you're not working?
Well, and you, well, you got to think you have 400 acres. That's free child labor. Each kid gets an acre.
Yeah. Well, did they have the 400 acres still?
I think they were starting to have kids while they had the 400 acres. Then they lost the 400 acres and then had more kids. I'll get to how many kids they had in a minute. It's a lot of kids.
Ooh.
It's a lot of kids.
19 and counting?
Pretty much. They would end up having a total of 16 children.
Jesus
Christ. 16 of them little monsters running around.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of kids.
I see families of like 5, 6, and I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
That's chaotic.
My family of 3 kids is enough to make me go insane.
Borderline insane. You're still keeping it together.
You only see what you
should. On a good front. let's see here. Ken McElroy was born on June 16th, 1934, in Overland Park, Kansas, at the height of the Great Depression. And I think he was number 15 of the 16 kids, if I remember right. I didn't put it in here. Probably should have. The family was constantly moving around, and they were just barely scraping by. When the 4 oldest McElroy boys got old enough, they basically went straight to work to help make ends meet. Because, again, you have all these kids. You got to feed them.
Mm-hmm. Got to have room for them.
Yeah. This made it to where the family was finally able to rent a home in Skidmore, Missouri, and they decided to settle there.
That is an unfortunate name.
Awful name.
Skidmore.
Skidmore. Well, Skidmore is a very small farming town. With so many kids in the house, and Tony and Mabel basically working all day, every day, the kids were basically neglected. I mean, they were just left at home to fend for themselves because the parents are working all the time. The older siblings are working all the time. So they basically had zero supervision, no structure in the home. And when Ken would get the attention of his parents, it was normally negative. It was normally because he did something that he wasn't supposed to do, or just getting in trouble was the only attention he ever got. So again, just right off the bat, you feel bad for these kids. Yeah, they turn into these terrible monsters, but then you hear their childhood and you feel bad for them as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But then they get older and it's like, okay, you could have made a different decision.
Mm-hmm.
Even his relationship with his siblings were strained. They basically just ignored each other. Ken would spend a lot of time by himself outside. He didn't really attend school, but on the rare occasions that he did, the teachers would have to pull him to the side and basically show him how to shower himself and force him to shower himself. And at times it was so bad that they would just send him home because it was becoming a distraction to the other children. At 15 years old, he would end up dropping out entirely. He was known to be mean and bully the other kids. Ken would fight other students, even pulling a knife out and threatening other kids. He would then be caught stealing from a local store. The store owner would then call Tony to let him know, like, hey, your kid stole from my store. And to me, as a parent, you discipline your child. I'm like, okay, you little shit. Like,
We ain't doing this
again. We ain't doing it. Well, that's not what Tony did. Tony would go to the store, slam the owner against the wall, and held a giant curved hunting knife up to his throat. And basically said, if you lay your hand on my kid again, like, I'll rip your heart out, basically, is what he told him. Which I'm sure back then, I don't know why he said, if you touch my kid again, like, did he smack his hand, like, caught him, like, hey,
put it back.
Don't touch that. I don't know. So, he's getting all this negative attention, and then his dad does this, and that almost shows him, like, hey, I'm untouchable. I can do whatever I please. And there's no consequences. So again,
rescue me.
Yeah, starting off right off the bat, just not a good structure. After this incident, his behavior got worse and worse without any fear of consequences. After dropping out of school, Ken would get odd jobs, but would often be fired after a short time. He had no regard for authority, he had a terrible work ethic, and he had a horrible temper. There were rumors that, and here we go, we're going to just jump right into it. There were rumors that he had raped a 14-year-old girl, and she would end up being pregnant with twins.
Holy shit.
It is said that the girl would end up dying while giving childbirth because her family could not afford medical care.
Wow.
That's
terrible.
Awful. We're going to get worse. We're going to get awfuler. A year later, Ken would then come back and rape the girl's older sister.
What the fuck?
That girl would end up going on and marrying one of Ken's, like, his hunting buddies that he had. We're just... Yeah.
It's bizarre. It's awful.
Just wait. It just keeps happening and keeps happening and keeps happening. And it's like, where are the police? Like, where? I know it's back in the day, but still, like, there had to be morals. There had to be authority. Like,
some sort of justice.
It's insane. Oh, just wait. That's just barely scratching the surface. At 18 years old, in 1952, Ken would marry 16-year-old Oletta Holland. That's considering not too bad. 16 and 18, not great, but at least it's not 14 and 20, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ken and Oletta would move about an hour away to Denver, I think it's Colorado. I've seen a couple of different sources, and I don't know if there was just confusion. Some of them said Denver, Colorado, which obviously I know, but some of them said Denver, Missouri. I don't know if there is a Denver, Missouri, so.
I have no idea.
They moved to a town called Denver, maybe Colorado, maybe Missouri. Oletta was pregnant at the time of the move. Did you need to tell me something?
No. Oh, but if we're taking a break real quick, I need a drink.
Okay, sure. Take a break. You popped up really fast and I was like, oh my God. Oletta was pregnant at the time of the move, but the baby ended up being stillborn. Ken had gotten a construction job and he promised Oletta that with the move, it was a fresh start. And he was determined to make a change, which it's like, good on you. Way to be, buddy. Like, you've got a wife now. Get it sorted out. And he did seem to be doing really well. Until one day, an accident would happen. A large piece of support structure fell from a 30-foot drop right above Ken and landed directly on his head.
Damn.
It had so much force that it split his hard hat in half, cut his head open, and would end up compressing his spine, causing permanent nerve and spine damage.
Wow. Ooh.
So he starts off with not a great life. That's a red flag. Then he has a traumatic head injury. Red flag number two. Mm-hmm. That's how all serial killers start out. Not all, but a lot. After the accident, Ken and Oletta would end up packing up and they'd move back to Skidmore and settling at a small farm. Shortly after moving back, Ken went back to his criminal ways. He would actually rig his truck up so that it could, he had like a toggle switch where he could flip the switch and it would turn all the lights off on his truck. And then he took like plywood and like reinforced the back of it so it could hold like really heavy loads. And he would then drive around local farms looking for animals, and he would sneak in the middle of the night and steal the town's animals and sell them to like the neighbors down the street.
That's crazy.
And again, it's a super small town, and most of the people knew what he was doing, but they basically would just turn a blind eye because they knew of his temper, and they were just like, ignore it and act like it didn't happen.
If they knew about it, why were they still buying the animals?
Good question. Well, because it's a good deal. He's like, I got $20 for this pig. And they're like, all right, deal.
You just drop it off in the pen.
Yeah. Well, when Ken was in his early 20s, Ken began hanging out with people much younger than him. One of his supposed best friends was a boy named Larry that was 10 years younger than him.
And you said he was how old?
Early 20s.
So he was probably like what? Like
hanging out with like a 12-year-old
boy.
What in the world?
He would also be known to hang out with girls around the same age as Larry. It's often believed that Ken would use Larry to gain access to these younger girls. There was a specific girl named Barbara in her late teens that was known to basically be his drinking buddy. They'd hang out and drink all the time. But she wasn't the only one. He would hang out with any girl younger that he could, and he would tell them that they didn't have to worry about him because they were too old for him. He liked his women young and tender. He likes that.
What?
He would say, I like that young meat.
Oh, wow.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
Absolutely disgusting. I think Seth's going to throw up.
Yeah.
You're old, he's like, oh, I like him younger than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn.
During this time, he is still married to Oletta. Some of these girls, and let's call it what it is, he was raping them, were as young as 12 to 13 years old.
Jesus Christ.
I believe we call this grooming.
Yeah. One of these girls, referred to as Donna G, would sneak out at night and go be with Ken. She would end up pregnant about a year later and give birth to Ken's first child. Ken was also having an affair with 15-year-old Sharon. During a fight one night in a car, he would point a shotgun at her head and told her that if she didn't shut up, he would blow her head off.
The fuck?
After saying this, the gun went off and hit Sharon underneath her chin and her neck.
Hmm.
The police were called, charges were filed against Ken, and Ken would tell Oletta that he needed to divorce her and marry Sharon to get out of the charges.
Because marry the girl he shot?
Because if they're married, she can't testify against him.
This is insane.
They got a divorce, and Ken would then end up marrying Sharon. After they were married, shortly after, she would give birth to a boy named Jerome, who would end up being raised by Ken's sister.
Oh my God.
So he grooms and rapes this girl. He shoots her in the neck and chin.
And then gets her to marry him?
Gets her to marry him, which I'll explain more of that on down, and you'll see how he would get them to marry him. And then she would have this baby, and I don't know if she willingly gave the baby up or if it was it was like no choice. Like she didn't have a choice in it. If she just had to give the baby up, I don't know.
That's nuts.
Hopefully she did, thinking, you know, the dad isn't going to be a good figure, obviously. He shot me, you know.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine. I could not imagine, or being her parents. Ken was never convicted of this crime. Never convicted of shooting this girl. He would then continue with his multiple crimes, including, but not limited to, assault, burglary, illegal sales, sexual assault, intimidation, threats, attempted murder, but he was never even charged with that. But it did happen. Insane.
Wow.
At this point, he basically ran the town and could do whatever he pleased. No one would stand up to him in fear of what he would do to them and their families in retaliation. In 1968, now we're getting it. You thought that was bad. Just wait. Again, that was just scratching the surface.
It gets worse.
It escalates and escalates and escalates. In 1968, Ken, Larry Combs, Raymond, and Glenn Hayward were arrested for the assault of 52-year-old Glenn Graham. Graham and his daughter, Anita, went out to check their horses. While they were in the field, suddenly Ken came from a nearby house and started shouting at Graham, accusing him of calling him names. So what I'm fixing to tell you is because Ken decided this guy was supposedly, like, mean mugging him and calling him names. And this is what they do. So Graham tried calming him down. He's like, I don't even know you. I didn't call you any names. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Trying to, like, calm down. Like, calm down, sir. And suddenly, Ken punched Graham in the face, and the other men began attacking Graham with brass knuckles and a bat. Anita heard the loud commotion and she ran over to see what was going on, and that was when she seen the men attacking her father. So of course Anita runs over to try and help him, but one of the men grabbed her, threw her against a car, and he would end up choking and punching her, and he would threaten to kill her if she moved. And had to sit there and watch these guys attack her father, and just wait until you hear how bad the attack was. A neighbor heard everything going on, so he came over to see what was going on. As soon as he tried to help Graham, another one of the guys attacked him. Before the men left, they threatened Graham and said if he reported the attack, they would come back and do the same thing to his daughter, Anita. Graham was beaten so badly that one of his eyes was literally kicked out of his head, according to a sheriff's report.
Wow.
He also had several broken bones in his ribs, his face, his jaw was broken in two different places. And with it being such a small town, of course they knew who the men were that attacked them. They were arrested for assault and charged with intent to do grievous bodily harm. A judge would allow the release of the men on a bond of $2,500, and they only spent a couple of days in jail.
I didn't know that Missouri had lenient judges.
Two of the men took a polygraph test and denied being involved in the attack, and they passed.
Yeah, like, polygraphs are admissible in court, though.
Yeah, they're not used. And to me, that kind of shows you these men and their intent, because, you know, polygraph are, it's off your heartbeat and your, you know, basically emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have no emotion because they don't care, of course they're going to pass because they're freaking psychopaths.
My mom watches this one show, it's like How to Catch a Killer or something like that, and it's one of them shows, and they do polygraphs on like all of the supposed assailants or whatever you would say. And aside from just not showing any emotion, there's other ways that you can like flaw the system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that 100% they're not like admissible in court for those solid reasons, just because you can't get an accurate reading.
Right. It's not, there's no true and tried way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after that, Graham and Anita were also required to take a polygraph. And of course, they stated that Ken, Larry, Raymond, and Glenn Hayward were all involved. And they also passed the polygraph test. And which I was listening to Morbid, and where I got a lot of my information. And the judge of that county said, oh, this is the first time that I've had opposite, two different sides say complete opposite and both pass the test. And it's like, okay, but you know these guys are criminals. You know they do this. Why?
Right. They've all got a history. Yeah. And here you are siding with them still. That's kind of like the judges there in California being, they just let murderers
just let them go.
Walk.
It's okay.
All day.
Let's see here. The men would continue with their criminal activity afterwards, and it would even escalate and worsen over time.
How do you escalate that? That's like attempted homicide. The next step up is homicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The men would continue with their criminal activity afterwards. It would escalate. Fertilizer and pesticides were stolen from a co-op. Not once, but twice. And it was worth thousands of dollars. Finally, the co-op hired an elderly man to keep watch at night, thinking they would come back and they would catch him. A few weeks go by, and then the guard heard someone trying to break into the building yet again. The guard would yell, and he scared the thieves off, and they began running away. He had a shotgun and kind of fired it in their direction, kind of like a warning shot or whatever. And he never seen their faces. He never seen the thieves, so they didn't know who it was. Well, it was found out a few days later that Ken McElroy went to the town over that same night and had to have shotgun pellets removed from his ass.
Oh, wow.
So they found out who it was. The town was growing very tired of it. Like, they were tired of him offending, reoffending, and just no consequences, and just everything going by. Not only was he stealing property, physically attacking people, but his predatory behavior was also worsening. In 1961, at 26 years old, he began an affair with 15-year-old Alice Wood while he was still married to Sharon, the one that he married originally after shooting in the face. In 1964, he would move in with Alice and then marry her in 1968. And just like with the other relationships he had, he would be physically, sexually, and emotionally abusive. All around scum. While early in their relationship, Alice one day was putting clothes into a box to, like, for the next season or for the season that just passed, kind of, you know, circulating your clothes for the seasons. You better not fall asleep, sir.
I've been falling asleep
for a second. I know. Open your eyes.
Let me get a drink.
It's like having Tori in here. Jesus.
I'm tired.
Get over it.
You choose to record at 10 o'clock.
We're exactly. Almost done.
Hey, ghostly gang. The case is cold and the vibes are haunted.
We've got murder notes, EMF spikes, and no business being awake this late.
But thanks to W Energy Drink, we have clean energy with no crash, so we can hyperfixate on timelines, suspects, and whether or not the attic is haunted or a squirrel is hiding his nuts.
The flavors are criminally good. Like, we destroyed the evidence good. Not a drop could be found.
It's zero sugar, no artificial colors, and delivers terrifying levels of focus and mental clarity. Perfect for connecting red string and angering spirits.
Hit dubby.gg.com.
Use promo code GGP for 10% off.
Dubby, fueling guilty in the ghostly while the killer's still out there.
And the house is still haunted.
Uh, Early in the relationship, Alice was putting some clothes in a box to put away for the season, and Ken came home, and he immediately was irate, thinking that she was packing to leave him.
I knew it was coming.
He would grab Alice by her hair and threw her against a wall and physically attacked her.
Hmm.
And this was very common in all of his relationships. Anytime that the parents of these girls would try to intervene, Ken would stalk the parents, sit outside their homes, and like just watch. And then he would just randomly fire shots outside their home all hours of the night, sometimes weeks and nights, over and over and over. And they were like scared to leave their homes because they were afraid he was going to shoot them.
That's insane.
This guy's a nut.
Just saying, as a father, I would have fixed that once evening.
That's what I don't understand is, which he was a very big guy. Like, when you see pictures of him and everything, he was a very, he had an intimidating
build.
Yeah, he was a skip. But still, I mean, it's just insane that this went on for so long. The townspeople would do what they could to protect themselves, but they were terrified of what he would do in retaliation and always seemed to get out of it. And because that was another thing. They're like, well, we can press charges, but then they're just going to let him go. And now he's going to be
angry,
even more angry, and attack us even worse. So they're just kind of like, what?
You just turn a blind eye.
Yeah, what do we do?
Hmm.
Then in 1969, at 27 years old, he met 12-year-old Trina McNeely.
This, you know, his little crime spree hasn't been that long. This started in his early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
He's only 27 at this point.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Insane. Trina's uncle, Russ Johnson, was a sheriff's deputy and would later find out that Ken would hang out at middle school dances, and he would end up intimidating Trina's date that was supposed to take her to the dance, forced him to pick Trina up to take her, and then he made that date take her back home. But when he brought her to the dance, Ken would go hang out with her. And then that way the parents wouldn't know.
What the hell?
Oh, I was like, why is he?
That is insane.
30-year-old man hanging out at the middle school dance.
Yeah.
You guys know the Dougie?
Dougie. Oh, it's just infuriating.
It's gross.
Yeah.
After that, her peers then, it was kind of like common knowledge that Trina was hanging out with Ken. And at first, he was basically forcing her to do it. He would show up after school and force her in the car. And if she ever was like, no, I'm not doing that, he ended up setting her family's home on fire.
Holy crap.
Because she would say no. He shot her dog another time because she told him no. So because he's escalating, she's like, I've got to. This poor girl, preteen girl's like, well, I've got, what do I do?
My part.
Yeah. And so she would eventually just go along with it. And it got to the point to where she was skipping school and he would pick her up from the bus stop. And then she would have her friend sign like her little note for school saying she was absent and turn it in just to keep everybody kind of not knowing. But,
right. But
then again, everybody knew. So it wasn't really. Everybody knew, but again, pretended not to know, I guess.
Just kind of turned a blind eye.
Yeah. Over time, she would become secluded, and her friends began distancing themselves from her, which is what they do. They get their victims secluded.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, she just gave in, and she would just do whatever he said. In 1971, when Trina was just 14 years old, she would end up pregnant and drop out of school.
Wow.
While all of this is going on, he was still with Alice, the last wife.
He's probably way too old for his taste at this point.
Exactly. And I seen in some of the research that I was doing, a lot of the marriages weren't even valid because they overlapped.
Mm-hmm.
So, wild. She dropped out of school and again, while all this is going on, he's still married to Alice. Again, to avoid any charges, because now he's like, crap, she's pregnant, she's underage, I'm going to get statutory rape charges against me. He's like, you're going to let me marry her. And they were like, no, we're not. And he said, if you don't, I will kill you, your other kids, her. And so eventually they got married.
That's one way of asking for a blessing, I guess.
That is insane.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, you know what? You hold up. I've got a wedding gift for you in the other room. You just give me 1 minute.
Be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Close your eyes. It's a surprise.
From the other room.
It's a surprise. Have you guys seen that TikTok of that little boy?
No.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you'll have to watch it. It's this little boy. He's covered in dirt, and his mom. He's like, "Do you like surprises?" And she's like, "Yeah." He goes, "Follow me. It's a surprise." It's so creepy, but so funny. Okay. Well, back to the Debbie Downer. So he ended up divorcing Alice and he married Trina. In 1973, he was charged with forcible rape, arson, and assault with a dangerous and deadly weapon. The charges would later be dropped. So during all of Ken's criminal activities, you know, raping, pillaging the town of Skidmore, a way that he was getting out of all this is he would hire this cutthroat attorney named Richard E. McFadden, known as Gene. Ken went into McFadden's office and he's like, hey, I want to hire you. And the attorney's like, you can't afford me. And Ken reached in his pocket and grabbed a whole wad of cash and just threw it on his desk. And the attorney's like,
you can afford
me. Okay, here we go. Yeah. McFadden represented McElroy in numerous criminal cases, often employing legal maneuvers such as changing venues and repeated delays, which helped McElroy avoid convictions in many instances over the decades. He was notorious and controversial in Skidmore for repeatedly securing the delays and acquittals for McElroy, which, of course, contributed to local resentment toward both him and his client because of it. Because the townspeople are like, what are you doing? You keep getting this guy off of these charges. They can't do anything about it. And so it was a constant cycle. It's a
failed justice system right there.
Mm-hmm. It was so bad that in 1976, Ken shot his neighbor, Romaine Henry, in the stomach after an argument. Romaine survived, and Ken was arrested. But before the trial could begin, Ken would burn down the judge's barn, stalk multiple jurors, to the point where he eventually was just acquitted for the crime.
What in the hell is wrong with the justice system here?
I guess it's such a small town, you know the whole juror.
I guess.
Oh my God. But,
you know, I've heard of, well, it was like the last story we talked about, you know?
Yeah.
He didn't want, or y'all talked about, he didn't want a huge...
Didn't want like a production made out of it.
Right, and, or he didn't want the news to get a hold of it, and so they sped the trial along and do it with this dude.
Yeah. Well, 4 years later, Ken would shoot yet another person. In July 1980, McElroy confronted Ernest Bo Bowenkamp, a 70-year-old grocer who owned the local store, after a dispute that began over one of McElroy's children allegedly taking candy from the store. Full circle.
I was like, wait a minute, hold on, are we back at the beginning here?
Full circle. McElroy pulled a shotgun and fired at Bowenkamp at close range, hitting him in the neck and torso. Despite the severity of the wounds, Bowenkamp survived the shooting. McElroy was arrested and charged with attempted murder for the attack, but the charges would end up being reduced to second-degree assault.
That's crazy.
Which is a serious felony. And he was sentenced to 2 years in prison.
That's it?
However, He is released on bond while appealing his conviction.
What in the hell?
Infuriating the community.
How do you appeal a conviction when you've got a rap history longer than a CVS receipt?
No idea. It is insane.
Jeez.
And then you...
Hang on, let him finish the end.
Hang on, let him die.
We're good.
And then you see these people getting charged when they're completely innocent, and they're like, oh, straight to jail, straight to prison for life with you. But then you have this guy who just repeatedly offends and offends and offends, and it's like...
Attempts, murders, attempts, homicide.
Insane. Well, shortly after being freed on the appeal, Milk Elroy showed up at a local bar armed with a rifle and bayonet. And made additional threats against Bowen Camp. So he's pissed off because he actually kind of got in a little bit of trouble and went back to give this guy trouble.
A piece of word, peace with man.
Yeah. This, of course, was a violation of his bond.
I'm sure.
A witness agreed to testify at a bond hearing against him. However... Right before the hearing was supposed to happen, the townspeople found out that the hearing had been delayed to an undecided date. At this point, the townspeople are furious. This man has escaped any consequences for any of his crimes. And he's just escalating one after another after another. They're terrified. They don't know what to do. And on July 10th, a large group of Skidmore residents decided to hold a town meeting. The meeting was held in the Legion Hall in the center of Skidmore. Dozens of residents gathered, estimated range of around 40 to 60 people, to discuss how to protect themselves and other witnesses from Mick Elroy's ongoing threats. Nottoway County Sheriff Dan Estes attended and advised the group not to confront Mick Elroy directly. He suggested forming a neighborhood watch or finding legal ways to protect the townspeople instead. Because that's worked so well.
Right.
Oh, man.
While the meeting was happening, Mick Elroy drove into town with his wife, Trina, and went into a local D&C tavern to get a drink. Word of this quickly reached those that were gathering at the Legion Hall, and Sheriff Estes reiterated his advice to avoid confrontation, and then he left Skidmore in his cruiser, removing official oversight of the gathering.
He said, make sure you guys don't go near Mr.
Elroy.
Yeah.
Don't shoot him.
And I'm going to go for a nice long drive in the country.
He like slid his gun over. Do not use this gun to shoot him. Right. Exactly.
There are loaded bullets in the chamber.
I'm just going to look over this way. Whatever you do is what you do. Yeah. Just get ready. So he leaves. He leaves the meeting. He's like, deuces, y'all do what you gotta do. So the bartender recalls that Ken was fuming about what was going on and that his actions have finally caught up to him. He even told the bartender, because at this point, he's about 50 years old. He told the bartender, I have been fighting prosecutors since I was 13 years old. I am now 50, and this is the first time that I have lost. Poor freaking baby. They knew since he was fuming that something was building and something unpredictable was about to happen. They had it had everybody on edge. The group of men that were at the Legion Hall decided to walk over to the tavern. They walked in and Ken was still at the bar going on and on about how mad he was. He finished his drink. The group of men just sat and watched him, and it was dead silent in there except for him talking about how pissed off he was.
They're all just sitting around the bar, just staring at the back of his head.
Yep. Once he finished his drink, he stood up and walked out of the tavern.
So did everybody else.
The group of men stood up and walked outside where Ken was walking to his truck and where Trina was sitting waiting on him in the truck. He got in the truck, took his keys out, lit a cigarette, when suddenly a gunshot cracked through the air. And then another, and another, and another, coming from all different directions. One bystander had pulled Trina from the truck while all of this is happening. No one knowing who was firing or what guns were being used. Then suddenly, it stopped. The first shot shattered the back window of the truck, hitting Ken in the base of his skull, going through his tongue, and then his teeth before exiting out his cheek. Second shot from a different rifle went through his skull, then his brain, exiting the side of his head. There was also a shotgun used that peppered the side of the truck and hit Ken in the side of the neck. Full circle moment again.
Mm-hmm.
Once the shooting stopped, someone called the sheriff to let him know that Ken Elroy had been shot and was dead.
I would have just been like, oh, there's a shooting down at the Legion, man. You just go down there and check it out if you want. If you don't, you know.
If you don't, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Well, due to the sheriff having attended the town hall meeting, it was considered a conflict of interest, so he couldn't investigate. McElroy had terrorized Skidmore and Nottoway County for years. Local deputies knew the victims. Some officers had personally dealt with McElroy's threats. Many witnesses were friends, neighbors, or even relatives of law enforcement. And an investigation handled locally would have been immediately viewed as biased or compromised. The case would then be investigated by Northwest Missouri Investigative Squad. The conclusion of Ken McElroy's death isn't about who pulled the trigger. It's about what happens when a system fails for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Rex McElroy was killed in broad daylight in front of dozens of people on a main street in a small town. Investigators knew that. Prosecutors knew that. The state knew that. And yet no one was ever charged.
Nobody saw a thing.
Two grand juries were convened. No indictments were handed down. Not because there was no evidence, but because there were no witnesses willing to speak. The town stood together and no one would utter a word. It was later determined that there were at least four different shooters, and his death officially remains unsolved. Unofficially, it stands as one of the clearest examples in American history of community silence. A collective decision to say nothing, remember nothing, and move on.
Take care of the problem. Take out the trash.
They were done with it.
It'll stink no more.
There's only so much that you can handle before. I mean, what else were they supposed to do? Let them keep going?
They tried the legal route.
Yeah, they'd been trying it for 40 decades. Years. 40 years. And so finally they're like, we had enough.
Well, clearly he's gotten away with this much. So, you know, we just say we didn't see nothing.
Yeah. And literally nobody said a word. Like, they could pinpoint to where the shots came from, but nobody would admit to being there or have seen anything.
Mm-hmm.
So they were never to charge anybody.
That's a good cold case.
Yep. I'm okay with that one staying cold.
Mm-hmm.
Insane.
And that's a good example of, you know, just what happens when the justice system fails and the community gets tired of it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't
condone murdering, or but
vigilanteness or whatever you would say, but
in this case, I was understand. Justice
served.
I understand. Yep.
I think that should have came a long time ago. I think he probably got away with it probably a little easy, but
yeah.
Oh, yeah, he definitely did.
Yep.
He definitely did.
He got what was coming.
That's crazy, though.
And I've seen some interviews, and again, it just goes to the trauma, and I feel really bad Trina still backs him. Like, he has
had the wife he was with when
he has her so brainwashed that she was like, oh no, you guys didn't see what I seen. That those are just rumors and people saying that he did, but nobody ever saw any of it. And I'm sad. Kind of sad. But I couldn't imagine the trauma that she's been through.
Well, I mean, not trying to, like, say anything good about the guy, but he did try to get his life turned around there at the early 20s and wound up having a terrible accident that, you know.
Could you imagine, which again, it's like the butterfly effect. Like, what if that would have killed him?
Mm-hmm. And there wouldn't have been this many victims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder. Just one little thing can change the complete trajectory of everything.
Or, I mean, in like a positive way. Maybe had it not landed on his head and just broken his toe or something, you know, maybe he wouldn't have been like a complete terrible person, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe he'd have just been
maybe a good, he would have turned around and
good husband. And well, we'll never know.
Never know. Because he's dead.
Yeah.
Yep. Good riddance.
Good riddance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all I got.
That was a good one. It was.
I was hoping you'd like it.
I mean, it wasn't like gruesome in a way that like the Torso Killer was.
Yeah, that was
still terrible.
Different kind of gruesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the kind of gruesome you wish somebody would have gotten justice just a little bit sooner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I've got some more good ones coming up. I've actually got 4 books that I need to read for the next couple of cases. And then we've got our guest appearance coming up. We've got the tour coming up in March. That's going to be really cool. I can't wait to announce what that is and get to go do that. So a lot of cool stuff in the works behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how it goes. Our numbers are growing. Like, they have almost doubled what they were. Especially the second part of the Torso Killer.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the biggest jump that I've seen. That was kind of cool. And we're still have more listeners than what we have been. So welcome. We appreciate it. We appreciate the support. Like, share, subscribe, comment. Mm-hmm. Send us your suggestions. Send us your personal accounts. Spooky. Aliens.
Just say hi if you're bored.
Yeah,
say hi. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Tell Josh to wake up.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If it's not Tori falling asleep, it's you falling asleep.
Look, it's late.
It is late.
I'm tired.
Me too.
We just got our bellies full.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, well, I guess that's it. So until next week.
Thank you guys for having me back.
Yeah.
Yep.
Stay spooky.
Take it easy.
Justice should be served.
Oh, it was served cold this time.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Later.
Tater.
Alligator.
Josh is done.
Eisenator.